Hi, everybody. I'm Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Great to be alive and sober and at a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank the group again for this kind invitation to me to be here over the next few weeks to share my experience with and hope with this work, this spiritual revolution, the experience I had in seeking an experience that has transformed my life. Thank the Tapers for being here. And if I haven't done this yet, I apologize, but let me take a moment to thank all of you for being here each and every week and making this really a joy for me. Your questions have been wonderful. You guys look wonderful. Shoulder to shoulder, this common journey our book talks about. I'm very grateful to be in right in the middle of a pocket of enthusiasm with all of you guys. So I thank you for being here for me and making this easy and being very receptive to what's going on. God separated me from alcohol June 23rd, 1988. I'm a recovered alcoholic, no longer suffering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that's been done for me. I didn't will that. I didn't try to do that. It was done for me by following a few simple rules in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Spirit has been awakened, which on most days not only relieves me of the obsession to drink alcohol, but deals with a lot of my alcoholism, making me present to the moment, paying attention to the breath that goes in and the breath that goes out, being here with you of maximum service to God. My job as a recovered alcoholic is not only to take these principles into all my affairs, homes, occupations, and affairs, but also to work with other alcoholics and pull them through the archway where they can stand a free man at last. And God has given me some power to do that. I think I was sharing last week how we are around here a little bit and we do this work and we still say, I'm powerless, I'm powerless, I'm powerless. And yet on page 68, my big book tells me that God will demonstrate through me what he can do, and that requires some power. So I'm not powerless. When I align my will with God's will, God gives me power to do great things, suit up and show up and be present here now with you. I always like to open up with some questions or considerations that we can sit with, whether it's for this hour or maybe it'll come to you in a few weeks in a meditation. But at the very beginning, we talked about going to any lengths. And our book talks about any lengths and how it works, and it talks about going to any lengths in steps 8 and 9. So one of the questions we always want to sit with, am I still willing to go to any lengths? So last week we talked about inventory, and most people bail on inventory because it is one of the many any lengths we go to. For the first time in our life, probably, we're discovering obstacles in our path that are blocking us from having a spiritual experience with this power. For the first time in our life, we're discovering us, no longer pointing fingers or putting blame on others, even though other people were partly to blame for what they did to me or to us. We disregard for the first time what others did and hold a mirror up to ourselves and take a good hard look at self, seeking truth and seeing exactly what's in the way of me having an experience with this power. I try to be really clear last week or the week before on it, you know, often we'll hear, I need to find God, and God ain't lost. But the great reality is deep down in every one of us, and it's a matter of getting integrated with this power. And in order to do that, we have to discover obstacles and be rid of them, face and be rid of those things which are blocking me from this power. Now, that's work. That requires a whole lot of willingness on my part, and I'm sober 16 years, and each morning I still turn to this power and ask him for the willingness to continue doing this. So it starts with a mustard seed of willingness, and then we put pen to paper, and we follow a few simple rules, and then things are done for us. We wake up. Our sponsor will sit down with us, like my sponsor did with me, and ask me a question, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, well, sure, I'm willing to go to any lengths. And then I sit back in the back of my mind and say, I wonder what any lengths looks like. And trust me, if I knew what any lengths looked like before it showed up, I don't know if I would agree to some of it. This past year, for example, in my personal life, any lengths was really any lengths. It was not a cakewalk. But somehow we suit up, show up, put one foot in front of the other, and continually turn to this power. And we move. We get moved rather than driven by fear. One of the great lessons I've learned in going through this work is if you're doing your fourth step and you're experiencing no discomfort, uncomfortability, restlessness or irritability doing your fourth step, maybe you're not doing a fourth step. It ought to bring some things to the surface that does not make me comfortable. For the first time, I'm uncovering truth. And so there's going to be things in resentment inventory. There's going to be things in fear inventory. There are going to be things listed in sex inventory that I am not going to be comfortable with. Good. That's how it ought to be. It's going to war with our illness, God moving us through it. We can very easily get into, as we move along in this work, and pass through the archway, and move on with proposals 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and start moving through amends, and we fall into something that I experienced, and a great teacher of my life taught me. If it feels good, it doesn't mean it's good, and if it feels bad, it doesn't mean it's bad. I'm writing inventory, it does not feel good at all. In fact, it feels pretty uncomfortable, all to the good. And what we do when we're around here a while, some of us, is we become a prey to comfortability. I'm not sure if I spoke about this, but we get stuck on the second half of the first step. We do all this work in step four. We get disturbed a whole lot, and then we sit down in five, and we get six and seven questions. We answer them. We turn to this power. We go out and make amends. And little by slowly, we start to rest on our laurels. And a book tells us we're headed for trouble if we do. I become a prey to comfortability. My life gets somewhat manageable, and suddenly I think I'm managing my life. And everything starts to feel good, and I think that's wonderful. And little by slowly, any lens becomes any lens on my terms, not what the sponsor has given me, demonstrated through God to him. So am I kicking back if I'm around here a little while and resting on my laurels? Am I a prey to comfortability? Do I think because my life is manageable that I'm managing it? Our book over and over and over again uses words to express to us to continue to move, except for 1 hour after our fifth step. And even in that hour, I'm supposed to be doing something. We've talked a whole lot about the removal of self, the death of self for successful living, over and over and over again. And what's attached to self is ego. Ego, usually fueled by fear. Ego, clinging, needing, always wanting, attached to my external condition, yet so insecure on the inside, will do anything to survive. A greater sense of self. In order to survive, ego needs to attach itself to applause, pats on the back, more money, more possessions, more notoriety. You look great. You look great. Actually, you look wonderful. You're probably the best in the room. That's what ego needs, things like that. It's all a manifestation of self fueled by fear, and that stuff's got to go. Ego will never allow me, like anger, to sit with someone in this spirit and share exactly how I'm doing. Ego will never allow me to share fear or resentment or insecurities. It won't. It can't, because it'll die. But somehow going through this work, self starts to die. I brought me some reading that I work with out of a book, and it talks about self. Just bear with me, I'll read this to you. It says, kill self now. Self dethrone, that is the lesson. But in its place, put love for me, God. Knowledge of me, God. Self not only dethroned, but dead. A dead self is not an imprisoned self. An imprisoned self is more potent to harm. In all training, in mind of you and you, of others, let self die. But for each blow to life of self, you must at the same time embrace and hold fast the new life, life with God. It is not a dead self that men have to fear, but a thwarted, captive, imprisoned self. That self is infinitely more self-centered than the self allowed full play. And I had to sit with that, and it's because it's sneaky, clever, devious. But to you, my children, I teach a higher science law than even freedom of the self. I teach the death to the self. No repressions, just death. Petty self, life exchange for divine life. And now I can make more clear to you what I would say about forgiveness of injuries. It is one of my commands that I seek, that you seek my forgiveness, so you must forgive. But what you do not see is that you, the self in you, can never forgive injuries. the very thought of them means self in the foreground, then the injury, instead of appearing less, appears greater. All true love is of God and is God. So all true forgiveness is of God and is God. The self cannot forgive, kill self. And he goes on and on and on and talks about the death of self. And if I am in a place to offer forgiveness to you, doesn't that mean that self was still around, so I have to forgive you? That a part of self, a piece of self, was offended by actions you took. Make sense? We talked about fear inventory last week and about answering some of the questions in our big book about fear. And one of the lessons I've learned here is that the only antidote for fear is God. Having an experience with this power will give me faith in this power. The Spirit, God, this power, whatever you want to call it, will prove itself to me over and over and over again. The only antidote for fear is turning back to this power, and that is God. Now, my ego will allow me to think, because I'm acquiring things, we talked about this last week, I'm acquiring things, that self-reliance suddenly is working in overcoming fear. Because maybe for a moment I'm not having an experience with fear, but lose one of those attachments. One of the ducks are not in a row, and suddenly fear is on me and owns me again. How many times have I learned in inventory that I show up to relationships expecting you to give me everything to fix my internal condition? Now, sure, relationships are give and take. But I put demands on others. My pastor is putting demands on others that you fulfill me in every way, shape, and form. And when you didn't, fear showed up. It had to. And then I would do whatever fear told me to do. The same way when the obsession's on me and it tells me to go drink, I go drink. I'm a prey to misery and depression. Fear now owns me. And until I hit a wall with that and turn back to my Heavenly Father, was I able to experience one of the promises in my book, and that is, I outgrow fear. I'm not living in fear. Do I experience fear? Yes. Am I living in fear? No. And that's been done for me. How many times have I showed up to relationships? Look at many of my names in column one. It's because you didn't do this for me. You didn't. And I put these great expectations on others. Last week I talked about going through inventory and finding out that many times with resentment inventory that the first three columns turn out to be a lie. They're not about you. They're about me, because I put expectations on you to deliver and God to fulfill the script that I wrote out. And he didn't. And I saw how my first three columns, when I consider them carefully, especially my third column, funnels into Peter in the first column and God in the first column, and then fill in the second column as long as I like. Big Book says we considered it carefully. What is it? Our columns, my third column. And I will see fear show up. I'll look at my fourth column and take a look at manifestations of self, and I'll see fear show up again and ego show up again. And that is my precursor into my fear inventory, by taking a look at what shows up in three and where it exists in four. And I have a fear inventory shaping up. That's why I consider this stuff carefully. That's why it is so important. It is vital that I sit with prayer before I write. Because the pen will move. The Spirit will move it. The other thing that showed up for me with fears was simple fears. Fear of being alone. Fear of dying. Fear of being poor. Fear of ill health. Fear of being in a dark room all alone. I had a fear when first time I went through this inventory. I remember I grew up with this fear of firemen. And I didn't understand why. I'm an adult. I see fire trucks. I was more fearful of them than the cops rolling down the block. Made no sense based on my track record, right? And then I'm writing inventory, and we uncover, discover, and discard. And things were uncovered to me, that when I was a little boy, it used to be a big poster of a fireman carrying a little baby, what was down a ladder out of a burning building, and I saw it taking him from his home. And I thought all firemen were going to come into my bedroom as a little boy and take me away from mom and dad. And so that sticks with me, and I grow up fearful of firemen. I'm an adult. And I write inventory, and I see the delusion in that. Got clear of that. I'm writing inventory. I was in kindergarten. Something happened to me in kindergarten. Very simple set of instructions that the teacher gave me in front of the room. And I remember for years I would walk into a classroom waiting to be scolded by a teacher because I heard terrible things in my mind and she gave me simple directions. I'm 28 years old and I'm writing inventory and kindergarten scene comes back and is running my show. Need to write about that, don't I? In order to be present here now and free, I need to go back into my past and uncover. Because if I'm not past, I will react now based on my past. What happened to me in the past will allow me to react the way I do now. I'll never get free. And it will prohibit my growth into the future. That baby sounds just like me when I walked in here looking for a drink, by the way. Where's my bottle? Page 68. It says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. I'm going to review what we did last week also. It says, we put them on paper. So we put them on paper, and I don't know how many times I've heard in contemporary AA meetings where people discuss inventory on the phone and there's no writing. It says, even though we had no resentment in connection with them, I asked myself why I had them. And here's a question I write down. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed me? And one of the questions I write down, along with this fear, is where did self-reliance fail me? And I begin to write. It says self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. I once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve, I like you to circle the word solve, the fear problem, or any other, and you could underline any other. Next paragraph says, perhaps there's a better way, we think so. We're now on a different basis. And this is, again, another shift in consciousness here. It says the basis of trusting and relying upon God. The more I turn to this power and he demonstrates his omnipotence, the more I can turn to him and know he's going to work in my life. I use problems in order for God to demonstrate his power in my life. I use as an opportunity, problems as an opportunity for me to experience more growth if I turn to this power. And here in step 4, they're already describing a shift in me and some great promises. We trust infinite God rather than my finite self. I'm in the world to play the role he assigns, and whenever I am in fear, I will start assigning roles to everyone, including God. Just to the extent that we do as he thinks he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable me to match calamity with serenity? And, you know, that isn't only in my external world, what's going on in front of me, but what's going on within. If I'm experiencing some disease or discomfort or some fear, if I turn back to this power over and over and over again, it's work. It says, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon my Creator. And I found if I do, I'm being falsely humble. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. And the verdict of the ages that faith means courage. Now, a teacher in my life has told me many times in AA, you'll hear, well, if faith, if you have fear, then courage can't be in the same room. If you have fear, then faith can't be in the same room. Well, as he told to me, when fear shows up, faith better be there. Because if it's not, I'm screwed. Go back to chapter 2, Gnostics. God, everything or nothing. So isn't God, God says, fear is here, so I'll wait for Peter to invite me in. Isn't God in everything? Isn't God here when there was nothing? If fear shows up, I better believe, and based on my experience, God is great reality deep down within. I just need to turn to it. Fear shows up. God is present. Contemporary AA will have you think that you have to send out an invitation for God to show up. And by the time God gets there, God knows what I'm capable of doing. You with me? Great promise. It says, we never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through me what he can do. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have me be. And at once, I commend to outgrow fear. We talked about sex last week, and not only sex, it had to do with roles as a man and as a woman. My expectations on what a woman ought to do, my expectations on me as a man, as how I ought to behave, as how I ought to be in all my affairs. Not only with sex, but personal relationships. It says now about sex. And I was so grateful to hear this next sentence. It said many of us needed an overhauling. But above all, we try to be sensible on this question. My book never judges me, nor does it judge me in sex inventory, where most of us get tight. Because we show up like I did with sex inventory the first time thinking I'm the only one ever wrote some of this stuff on paper. And I sat with my sponsor and he was pretty much bored with the whole thing. Told me if there's a name for it, it's already been done. And part of my sex prayer, a sex goal and ideal, that prayer I'm going to take to my Heavenly Father, was not about God, I did these terrible things and free me of this. But it was about taking a look at what was detrimental to me and others who were involved with me. How I hurt myself and how I hurt others. And how I no longer wanted to be in that bondage. I just wanted God to demonstrate through me what to do in that situation also. That was one of the many lengths I had to turn to, because I pictured, okay, God's going to place me here. And then here comes ego. I know it's better for you, better than what God knows for you, but I have to trust in this power. And then there's a shift in consciousness. And as I shared last week, my second and third inventories, when I wrote them, looked nothing like the first inventory, nothing like the first sex inventory I wrote, nothing. And when I was asked that question, do you have these type of items on your sex inventory? And I realized when I answered them, I said, no, I realized what a shift there has been in my consciousness because of this power. Nothing like the first inventory. My first inventory, I showed up with a lot of shame, guilt, embarrassment, remorse, you name it. And again, my sponsor looked bored with most of it. Last time through was nothing like that. It had to do a lot more with personal relationships. Me as a man, how I ought to be, and old belief systems, and how women ought to be. In AA, my personal affairs, working, you name it. And that was causing me some discomfort. I shared last week, in some of my affairs, I still thought I'm supposed to be John Wayne and walk through walls without a scratch and, you know, I got it. Could never do that. And I had to learn how to discard that. And the great lesson I've learned this past year is to ask others for help. Men, ask for help. Ego would never allow me to ask for help. Okay. It says, here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One said a voice cried that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity for procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex. I think that's the crew in the back over there against the wall, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. Let's skip down to the next paragraph. It says, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. And these are the questions we want to sit with and answer in inventory. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Who did I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? I'm not getting enough attention from this person, so how could I get more attention from them? Old thinking, old belief systems would say, well, I'll cause some jealousy and suspicion so I get more of your attention. That's selfish and self-centered and ego-driven. Why? Because fear is fueling the whole thing. I saw some of that in writing inventories over inventories. Unfair, and not someone who's supposed to be on this path. It says, where were we at fault? Not you, but me. Then it asks a great question, what should have we done instead? Not what could have I done instead, because if I could, that kind of is a tip-off that I suddenly have power to change that. And I didn't at the time, writing past inventory. What should have I done instead? It says we got this down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And last week, we talked about sane and sound ideals. We subjected each relation to this test, was it selfish or not. We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. And this is where I sat down and listened for, after some counseling with others, listened for an intuitive thought, inspiration coming to me rather than from me, and sitting down and writing a sex goal, a prayer that I can take to my Heavenly Father to mold me in His in the way He wants me to be, not the way I want to be. And again, that's derived at looking at what was detrimental to self and others. It says, whatever ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm. Sounds like step 9. Provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. And the right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counts with other persons is often desirable. We let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking and advice. And when I'm seeking counsel with others, I really need to know who I'm sitting with in this area, that they're awake, can be objective. And then I turn to God and I sit in meditation, and then I begin to write this ideal, this goal. Some very clear warnings coming up here. It says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. It's only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. Condition. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and have learned our lesson. And we talk about spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. And it is not to let anyone off the hook. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. I've had a personal experience with that of a dear friend of mine who had 5 years, goes through the work. His behavior didn't resemble someone who's on this path. He persisted, harmed others, and he's still on a drunk. That was about 10 years ago. We are not theorizing. These are facts of our experience. It says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, wholeness of mind, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the heart into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. Next paragraph. It says, if we have been thorough about our personal inventory, and that's a question I have to sit with, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. You see how I'm waking up to this and there's a shift. I can see this stuff as I'm writing. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill to all men, even our enemies. That is a great promise, and we haven't even sat down and did our fifth step yet. We have listed people we have hurt by our conduct, and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. Step 8 and 9. In our book, they ask us to also not only write resentment, fear, and sex inventory, to talk about principles and institutions. The first time I sat down and wrote inventory, principles were things I was given as a young boy. They were simple things that I really resented, like children should be seen and not heard. Belief systems about how a man ought to be, belief systems about how a woman ought to be, my place in my family, my place in society. Second time around, principles became clearly and clear-cut belief systems and attachments that I had to those belief systems. The last time around, this third time going through the work, I had an incredible amount of principles written down that I cannot believe were revealed to me. I had no idea what my fourth step was going to look like when I began. But there they were. Third time going through the work, I thought after this time I'd probably have maybe 10 names written in my first column. That's all I really probably need, about 10 names. I'm a spiritual guru. Don't need more than 10 names. Going through the work the third time. I sit down after prayer and meditation and begin to write. And the first writing, about 40 or 50 names come to me. And I call up my sponsor. I says, Mark, I think I'm doing something wrong. I have this many names. I did the work twice already. He laughed and says, good, keep writing. I had over 70 names this last time going through the work. And some of those names were still things from way back when, from past, that have not been resolved. Now, that disturbed me, but in the long run, it was a great thing because it showed me, Peter, this is not resolved, and it needs to be resolved. So it disturbed me, but I was able to get free of those things when I was a little boy still showing up. Talked about some of those things last week. Page 71 says, bottom of 70, I'm sorry, it says, in this book you read again and again that fate did for us what we cannot do for ourselves. We hope now you are convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made decisions, step 3, and an inventory of your gross handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. It doesn't say we're done, we're just beginning. I like you to underline the word beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. I've covered all areas in my life in writing inventory. And I've seen over and over again, I think I talked about this, how column 4 allowed me to take another look at what my thinking mind will do for me. All action is born in thought. And I see where my thinking mind takes me into my fourth column. I see where fear takes me when I write inventory. And the actions demonstrated because of fear, when fear fuels that. Chapter 6, Into Action. It says, we'll be talking about step 5 here, having made our personal inventory, and we just did that, what shall we do about it? So writing inventory and tucking it in the drawer or putting it somewhere hidden is really insufficient when it comes to seeking a spiritual revolution. We need now to discuss it with someone, and there's a force feeding of humility that goes into it. Sometimes we're sitting down with our sponsor and we say, I really don't want to sit with him or her and share this stuff. That's great. It's a force feeding of humility, which is what we all need to do to be rid of ego and self. That's a good thing when we're uncomfortable like that, I have found. It says we've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. These are about to be cast out, and it doesn't say we're going to deal with them or work on them. They're going to be cast out. They use words like trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator. And I like you to circle the words new, because what we're being here is being reintegrated with this power. We're not placed here separated from this power, but somewhere we do get separated. And what we need to do is be reintegrated with this power once again. And that's by having the obstacles in my path removed. It says, this requires action on my part, which when completed will mean we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of my defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. It says, this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There's doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find the solitary self-appraisal insufficient, and that goes back to, I need counsel to seek counsel with someone else. I'm moved by the Spirit to put on paper, and now I need to sit with someone and further reduce self, further be rid of ego by sitting with someone. This confession of shortcomings. Many of us thought to go necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. And here they're going to take us right back to step one. The best reason first. If I skip this vital step, life-giving or life-threatening, I may not overcome drinking. They take me back to step one. One of the any lengths I'm going to. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they've turned to easier methods. Currently, am I sitting with someone and reading reviews, reading nightly inventory, discussing my inventory with someone else? Or aren't I currently? How am I doing with that? Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. For me to complete house cleaning, then, I have to sit in step five. It's part of the process. They're two separate steps, but in order for me to complete house cleaning, part of that bargain, part of that deal, is me sitting down with another person and reading my four-step inventory to them. It says we took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. It says we only thought we lost our egoism and fear, only thought we had humbled ourselves, but that we have not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary. Until we told someone else all their life story, it's real easy to get into telling a little bit to you and a little bit to you and a little bit to the person in the back and conveniently leaving things out. And one of the any lengths I've experienced is sitting down with one person and letting them know all about me. A book is going to talk about person or persons. They use that expression, person or persons. What I've heard called multiple fifth steps. And we can sit down, as I've done the second time going through this work, with, had an appointment with one gentleman, and he heard my entire fourth step. And then I sat with my sponsor. And I found that the more people who are on this path who know about me, the freer I am, because self dies even more. Ego dies even more. The second time through this work, I sat with two gentlemen, a gentleman here in Jersey and my sponsor. And when I got done, I felt free. The nearness of my Creator. I didn't realize how free I was by that experience until I was up at a meeting in Harlem, and it happened to be the fifth step, and I realized sitting there, I was willing to share everything about me, except it would be in poor taste to someone on that list. I was ready to go for all of it, and I realized how free that had made me. There was no stone unturned, nothing hidden in the closet. I was made free. And so that has been my application to this, is sit with more than one person. Groups of people who are on this path will understand and be unaffected by what I'm giving them. Bottom of page 73. I'm sorry, middle of page 73. It says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much the actor. And we do that here currently. We show up to AA with the AA game face and we go home when we're not so sober. To the outer world, or the AA world, he presents a stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, and guess what? With egos involved, we need to enjoy a certain reputation. We must enjoy a certain reputation that the ego demands, that self demands. We have to. God forbid if you're the keynote speaker and you walk into a room and no one says hello to you, looking to take the hat and go home. Ego demands I get recognized, unless I'm in the sunlight of the Spirit, unless I'm having an experience with this power, then I'm no longer attached to that. And I can walk in, sit down, and wait to be called and be okay with all of it. Ego demands attention. I've learned that by writing four-column inventory. It says, the outer world presents a stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. We talked about anger sprees, fear sprees, sex sprees, money sprees, you name it. We experience strange mental blind spots in Alcoholics Anonymous getting taken on those sprees. And self-will can't overcome self-will. And there we are in the middle of a spree again. And God forbid if New York Intergroup saw us while we're behaving like that. God forbid if my home group saw me behaving like that. And I'm not talking about falling short in thought, word, and deed. I'm talking about that being my life. A double life. The great thing about being awake, it is no more duality. Here's some of the things about these sprees, about what I learned in fourth column, that we can be taken to. I'm just going to read a couple of things here. Irreverence. Failure to thank God or to express our gratitude adequately. Presumption. Dependence on self rather than God, with the consequent neglect of the means of grace, sacraments, and prayer. Dispensation of ourselves from ordinary duties on the grounds that we are superior persons. Satisfaction of complacency over our spiritual achievements, and our book talks about resting on our laurels. Distrust, expectation that others will dislike, reject, or mistreat us. Overratingness, so to interpret their attitude, a quickness to take offense. Walk into a room and they don't call on me. Walk into a room and they do call on me. Walk into a room and no one says hello. Unfounded suspicion in others. Disobedience, rejection of God's known will in favor of my own interests or pleasures. Talk about vanity. Crediting myself rather than God for my talents, abilities, insights, accomplishments, and good works. Refusal to admit indebtedness to others or adequately to express gratitude for the help. Pretense to virtues we do not possess. False humility. Harsh, listen to this, harsh judgments on others for faults I excuse in myself. You know when you're sponsoring someone and they forget to do something and you read them the Riot Act? The question is, am I doing what I'm telling my prospect to do? How come you didn't write inventory? You're not going to have an experience and I haven't written inventory in 2 weeks. Do we do any of that stuff? I read about anger, I think it was last week, is open rebellion against God and our fellows. Its purpose and desire is to eliminate any obstacle in myself, seeking to retaliate against any threat to my security, to avenge any insult or injury to my person. Malice, initiation, collection, or retailing of gossip, arousing, fostering, or organizing antagonism against others, unnecessary criticism even when true. So those are some of the things I discovered, and I can see, I have seen in myself, the actor playing the two roles, this double life, this duality. I'm here in AA and I do this, and when I'm home or in other affairs, have I experienced any of this stuff? I can never ever see that if I haven't been searching fearless and moral in writing fourth step inventory. I'll never see it. I'll never see it if I'm not sitting down with a person or persons and discussing it in step five. It just won't happen. Bottom of page 73, it says we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live longer or happily in this world. They talk about people to go see. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons, I like it on the line, Matt, with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must and, of course, will want to go to properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religion connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by established religion. Next paragraph says, if we cannot or rather not do this, we search our acquaintance for a closed-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps a doctor, a psychologist will be the person. Nowadays, with so many people who are on this path, even though we are a minority, I mean, in this room you could find a whole bunch of people to sit with and do a fifth step. The searching for someone to sit and do a fifth step is no longer an excuse. There are so many of us, even though we're the minority in Alcoholics Anonymous. Skip down a few sentences. It says, the rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And contemporary AA says, put the bat away, take out the feather, be good to yourself. You're being too critical of yourself. All these like wishy-washy, you know, therapeutic kind of things. And my book tells me in a few places, I must be hard on myself, but considerate of others. It's rigorous. It's work. When I sit down with someone, I usually read what follows. It says, notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, and maybe one is so situated there is no suitable person available. If that is so, the step may be postponed, only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. And we say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. And this is where I tell someone, I am the right person to sit with. It says, it is important that he be able to keep a confidence, and I let them know I can. That I fully understand and approve what you are driving at. They will not try to change your plan. And I will certainly not tell you as you're reading inventory, oh, don't worry about that, that wasn't that bad. We'll uncover, discover, and discard, and let God demonstrate through me what he can do. I have no idea what I'm going to say in sitting and listening to step five. And I've sat with many, many. There was one gentleman I sat with, 4 hours into inventory. 4 hours into inventory, and this guy's ego would not split. It would not break. And he was just adamant about reading his inventory that you did this to him. I took a break. I needed to take a break. And I retired to the restroom for a few minutes, and I asked my Heavenly Father, what do I do with this guy? And I sat quietly, and I came out, I sat down, and then something came to me rather than from me, and I asked this guy to begin reading only his fourth column. Never did this before, and I don't know where this came, well, I do know where it came from. Never did this before. And I had this guy read only his fourth column, no 1, 2, and 3 columns at all. I thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for me, besides him. This is what I was moved to do. And this guy began reading page after page after page of just his fourth column. And you know what happened, right? The guy split right down the middle. His complexion changed. His whole deportment changed. Everything changed about this guy. And I knew I got in. And he was starting to break. It was like the sword of God pierced this guy's ego and broke him down. He split right down the middle in front of me. And I knew it was an experience that I never had before, and I don't know if I ever will again, but there it was. It was an experience right in my dining room, at my dining room table. The guy, God be my witness, has never been the same. Has never been the same. And he let me know many times about my methods to help him get through this work. He was not a happy camper. And every time I see him, he thanks me and shares his gratitude for doing what we did. He sponsors a whole bunch of guys now. Can do a great workshop on this book. But up until that moment, ego was in the way, and then God moved me to do something I never tried before, and this guy split. Great stuff. And sitting and listening to fifth steps. So I read with them what we're about to do, and I'm not going to change your plan. I have no idea what's going to happen. It says when we decide to hear who is to hear our story, we waste no time, and that's a clear warning. See, because if I pick out sponsor or this gentleman a sponsor who's going to hear my story, ego is going to make me waste time because it knows it's about to die. Right? Well, maybe we shouldn't. The first time I sat down with a fifth step, I was working with my sponsor for a little bit of time. And on the way to his house with that appointment, something said, don't share this stuff. Who is this man? When I started with him, I thought he invented Alcoholics Anonymous. And suddenly he was this drunken AA, and you just don't do this with another man. And something moved me to drop to my knees. This father, get me to this man, because if I don't, I know I'm going to drink. And that's why I'm going. I just don't want to drink. And that was the condition. I showed up, knocked on his door, and we began. Haven't looked back since. It says we have a written inventory and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. And I know what and why you are here and what we're about to do. Where it's going to take us, I don't know. It's a journey that God has given you, and I'm going to assist. I do realize you're engaged upon a life and death errand, and I'd like you to underline life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help, and I'm not only glad, I'm honored and touched that someone comes to me and asks me to sit with them. They will be honored by our confidence. It says we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Stop. That is as before we read. What follows is what happens when we're done. So step five in our book is really split into two parts. What goes on before we read and what happens after we're done. We've taken the step. It says, once having taken the step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. And here's some fifth step promises. We are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. Someone knows about those things I've uncovered, those deep, dark secrets I thought I was going to take to my grave. Person or persons knows. And if I'm sitting with someone who's awake, they will give me feedback on similar experiences. They will give me some instructions. They will talk about some of their fourth step inventory with me, as it has been done for me and I do for others. It says we could be alone at perfect peace and ease, no longer restless, irritable, and discontented. This is a great promise. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease because self has died. Ego is no longer running the show. I'm at one with my creator. I go 4 through 9, not to reinvent myself, not to recreate myself, but to be one with this power. A book uses the words reborn, to be one with this power. When I'm one with this power and obstacles are cast out, I experience truth. I think at the first talk I mentioned and elaborated a bit on spiritual experiences about removal. Removal, over and over and over again. 4 through 9, I experience being one with God, nothing in the way of me in this power. I'm experiencing truth. Of course I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. That is now my current experience. That's my current experience, being alone at perfect peace and ease, feeling the nearness of my Creator, being able to look others in the eye. No longer feeling like I used to on the inside. My internal condition is well. It says we begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience, and it may be the infancy of one, but it has begun. It has begun. That's a tremendous promise our book is giving us. Way back when, I said, let's seek experience. I no longer seek belief. I no longer seek faith. I seek experience, because when I do, faith and belief is taken care of. Seek experience, and my book is telling me I begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. That's that oneness with this power. A book uses words earlier about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. What does that mean? No longer played by three dimensions, obsessions, emotions, feelings, attachments. I get rocketed into the fourth dimension where I'm one with this Creator. There's nothing between me and God. I'm one. The great reality deep down within now manifests in everything I do. My walking, my talking, my behaving, everything is God. I studied some work not too long ago, and they talk about this walking meditation. Walking to the store is a meditation. Driving my car is a meditation. Everything I do is in the Spirit of God. It's a meditation. Not the discipline sitting in the morning like I do or in the evening like I do. Everything should God should manifest in everything I do. Demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. When I'm one with God, there is no work to it. It's done for me. You with me? It says, returning home, we find a place where we be quiet for 1 hour. I like it on the line, 1 hour. It's the only time my book, my only place my book tells me about a time frame. But this is what I do in the hour. I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him better. That's a prayer. And I sit quietly for an hour, meditation, and I review the first 5 proposals. It says, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart. So I review the first 5 proposals. We ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an archway through which we shall walk a free man at last. And I like it underlined, at last. Because prior to that, my mind will have me think many times that I was free. Got into the right job. Boy, I feel free. This is what's working. The right amount of money. I'm getting free. My book tells me at last. Which tells me I've never been free up until now. At last. Is my work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? I'm building this archway where I'm passing through. Let God build the archway. I do this work. Have I skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have I tried to make mortar without sand? And some of the considerations for these questions are very simple. We look at step 1. Do I still believe I'm an alcoholic and my life's unmanageable? That I experience the phenomenon of craving once I start to drink? That I'm powerless over alcohol before I pick up the drink? Powerless in mind before I pick up a drink? Unmanageability, that my mind will take me back to a drink and I have no input into the decision that's made for me. Do I still believe that? Do I believe that my body is quite as abnormal as my mind? That my body will experience a phenomenon of craving when I drink? Do I believe I will experience strange mental blank spots without a spiritual revolution if I'm not current in this work, if I'm not experiencing this power? Am I still willing to accept spiritual help? And if not, no, I will go on to the bitter end. Am I willing to have God restore me to sanity, His wholeness of mind, where He will take me to this place? Do I believe God can and will relieve me of my alcoholism? Or am I starting to have reservations about that? Am I willing to believe what I currently believe in a power greater than myself? Am I still convinced that my life on self-will can hardly be a success? If I'm really having an experience, sure, I'm convinced. I no longer run the show. Do I understand by turning my will and life over to the care of God, my life is no longer any of my business? All of my life, in all areas. Now, God, you take care of the booze problem, but money and sex, got it. You can work on somebody else. Remember how it works when we read How It Works, and I says, I know for me and a lot of us, we sit in there and listen to grave emotional mental disorders and other areas. Say, those are those people, you know, at that other meeting or in this side of the room. It does not pertain to me. Oh, yes, it does. Bless you. Have I been thorough in this work in my 4th step inventory? Have I turned to this power to write? To be searching, fearless, and moral? Or have I tried to sneak something through the archway undetected that no one's going to know about? Have I tried to cheat my way through? It will show up. It has to. So I sit with these questions in my first 5 proposals. Have I sat with the people in front of me or the person in front of me and disclosed everything of my character to them? Regardless of what uncomfortability I was experiencing during it. Waking up is not pleasant. It's uncomfortable. It can be painful, as it ought to be, but we get free. There's a word I use many, many times to experience when we're on the other side, have oneness with this power, one word, and that falls short, and it's bliss. It says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six, and at this time, we will start step six, God willing, next week. Thank you for listening.